It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Chris Molina. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up later in the program, a Wisconsin-based researcher tells us why vacant buildings in American cities may not be as empty as you think, and why that can be a good thing.
First, President Trump's policy on illegal immigration has seen some significant pushback this week. Protesters marched in dozens of cities across the country yesterday, rallying against the administration's policy that results in the separation of families at the border.
A number of conservative religious leaders are also criticizing the policy. Those criticisms prompted this response from Attorney General Jeff Sessions yesterday.
Persons who violate the law of our nation are subject to prosecution. If you violate the law, you subject yourself to prosecution. And I would cite you to the Apostle Paul and his clear and wise command in Romans 13 to obey the laws of the government, because God has ordained the government for his purposes.
Sarah McKinnon is an immigration expert and associate professor of communication arts at UW-Madison. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's start off with what has changed in border enforcement under the Trump administration.
Yeah, absolutely. So currently, a program that was piloted in 2017 is beginning to ramp up, where border officials, ICE, as well as Border Patrol, are separating families at the border. And these are largely Central American families along the U.S.-Mexico border.
And the policy doesn't directly say separate families. It's kind of an indirect outcome, as I understand it, that the adults are being subjected to criminal prosecution much more often, basically across the board, which they weren't necessarily in the past.
Yeah, that's right. So effectively what's happening with the criminalization of immigration is once someone is apprehended at the border, they are put into deportation proceedings, which are connected to being criminal offenses. And at that point, children are separated from the families. And the government is effectively saying that this is necessary to do so we can begin the proceedings, the criminal proceedings, and children can be placed in protections.
And as I understand it, this is mostly about people who cross the way we think of as illegally crossing, not at a border site. It also, in some cases, do I have this right, people who come up and present themselves for asylum hearings at a recognized border crossing?
Yeah, that's correct. So it's happening across the board along the U.S.-Mexico border, so both at recognized ports of entry as well as other unrecognized sites. And in both instances, these may be individuals that would be applying for asylum, which is a protection for individuals who have a fear of persecution.
And now what's happening to the kids? I understand there's there are new sites where these kids are going. What's the policy on where they go and how they're treated?
Apparently there are new sites. Prior, there were some children that were being placed in kind of the social services system. There are facilities that house children, but as we learned recently, ICE has lost many of the children. They don't know where, and they can't, you know, record where these individuals are. And so there's been a significant ramping up of children being detained, effectively placed in detention. And also there's a sense of not knowing where some of these individuals are.
And people are sharing stories of how the children are being separated, parents being told their child was being taken to, I have questions asked of them, to be bathed in some cases. And we're seeing a lot more protests and reaction in response to the tactics as well as the separations.
That's right.
Themselves.
And the facilities there are highly under question, what the procedures are, what it looks like within the facilities, the care that children are being receiving, education services. And so there's a lot of nebulousness around this program. And I think in large part, this is why we're seeing a significant pushback in terms of the protests, because of the outrage of the inhumanity that it seems like the children are being treated under.
And we've heard their Attorney General Jeff Sessions saying, hey, this is just enforcing the law. President Trump has said he doesn't like this separation, but it stems from laws passed by Democrats and has called on them to change those laws. Is that, in your understanding of the law, accurate?
As far as I could tell, that is not accurate, that those were not laws that were in place, put into place by Democrats, nor was it something in terms of an interpretation. I mean, it really seems that this is an interpretation of an existing law.
talking to Sarah McKinnon from UW-Madison about recent immigration enforcement issues, protests, especially regarding the separations of families at the border. You study asylum laws quite a bit, and those have changed some. Restrictions are new restrictions on people who might have filed for asylum based on fears of domestic violence, for example. That's one of those changes. And the Trump administration looking for more changes beyond that. Can you talk about the role of asylum law?
Absolutely. So since 1967, the U.S. implemented or signed on to the right of non-refoulement. So that means that anyone who comes to the U.S. has the right to claim asylum, and they have the right to have the whole process that goes through. Well, this right to remain and throughout the process, I think we're seeing significant limitations put on that. Recently, we see that with the Attorney General's decision about domestic violence not being recognized as a social group under which you might claim asylum. The same is true with those that are fearing gang-related violence. And this is in large part connected to Central Americans who are fleeing Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, the Northern Triangle. And we see significant issues and concerns around violence in that area. And so I really see this as a mode of limiting the types of claims that Central Americans have and might be able to make through the asylum system.
And Attorney General Sessions has said, hey, the asylum laws are supposed to be for people who have been oppressed by their government in particular. And he says these are private crimes, domestic violence, gang violence. That, he says, doesn't apply. Does that fit your understanding of how asylum law works?
International law says that asylum is available when a government is unable or unwilling to provide for one's security. And so this is really a matter of interpretation. Attorney General Sessions is taking a very narrow interpretation of what political violence means. This is not the first time that we've seen this in the U.S. system of law. It wasn't until 2009, actually, that someone could validly claim domestic violence as a form of persecution. So this is quite recent, and so we're seeing a return back to a very narrow definition of the political, specifically in relation to types of violence that might be interpreted as private. And domestic violence, historically in U.S. asylum law, has existed in that interpretation.
The House is considering immigration measures right now. Mixed messages from the president today. He said he didn't like what he was seeing there, but then the White House clarified that he didn't understand a question being asked to him, I think. What are you watching for in Congress right now when it comes to asylum laws and the separation of families?
So that it looks like that the moderate bill that has been proposed at the House is addressing four particular issues. So sounds like ramped up monies for border enforcement, shifts to the asylum law. That's unclear to me what the particulars of those shifts are going to be. So that's something that I'll be looking for. And I think the significant aspect is it creates an aspect of immigration acceptance, approval for DACA available, DACA-eligible individuals. I really see that as a kind of divide-and-conquer strategy that perhaps Republicans are putting forth. So allowing students to have very slow process to possibly receive immigration, naturalization, legalization, while the others are thrown under the bus. And immigration activist groups are not going to fall for that. That's really a divide-and-conquer strategy that I think we've seen across the board and we'll probably continue to see.
As we wrap up, asylum status in particular, are you concerned that we are just going to dial back as a nation the numbers of people who are accepted for asylum status?
Perhaps. It'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, the United States does not really accept a lot of asylum seekers already. There are not many refugees in total in the country. I think the number is 0.08 refugees per 100,000 inhabitants in the United States. That's not a large number. But as we've seen historically with the Trump administration, they are really targeting refugee and asylum policy. So I won't be surprised if there are limitations to that.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Sarah McKinnon, immigration expert at UW-Madison, with us to talk about the latest on the Trump administration's policy that results in the separation of families at the border.
Take a trip to any major city in America, and you're likely to find the occasional vacant or abandoned building. To city leaders, these buildings can often be viewed as blight, but take a closer look and there might be more there than what initially meets the eye.
Our next guest has been researching vacant properties and how residents in one Philadelphia neighborhood have been interacting with them. Turns out that many of these buildings are taking on second lives, with residents finding alternative and unofficial uses, like community gardens or even informal housing. But these repurposed urban spaces can create conflict between a city's leaders and the residents who might rely on them.
Elsa Noderman joins us now to tell us more about this research. She's a PhD student in the UW-Madison Geography Department. Elsa, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So first off, what got you started doing this research, and what were you looking for?
Sure. So I think I've had a long-standing interest in this area. Before I came to graduate school, I worked at a nonprofit think tank that worked in the areas of community development, both in rural areas and urban areas. And something that often came up was housing affordability and access to land. And through my master's, which I also did here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, I explored manufactured housing cooperatives that were, I guess that's the technical term, mobile home communities that had formed cooperatives in response to the threat of eviction. Through that, I sort of began exploring the challenges and crises of people's relationships to private property, especially those who don't own land or their own homes. And I was interested in sort of exploring these issues more in Philadelphia, which is a city I used to live in, and is experiencing sort of fast-paced development over the last few years, partly in response to the fast-paced development of Washington, D.C. and New York, which has pushed more people into the Philadelphia area.
So I think a lot of people tend to view an abandoned building or a vacant building in their community as something that has failed, something that has died out. Is there something wrong with looking at it that way?
Right. Well, I mean, I think generally that's a perception that continues. And I think it's interesting how despite research in this area and a lot of conversations around this that have sort of pushed back against that notion, it continues. And I think part of the problem with that is it ignores, first of all, how those properties became abandoned in the first place. You can sort of look at the history and sort of the continuation of redlining, as well as the more recent mortgage crisis and foreclosures. And so first of all, I think it ignores that, as well as it often gets applied, vacancy gets applied not only to infrastructure, but also the surrounding community, so to people. So it not only sort of erases past and structural inequalities, but it also erases sort of present lives and futures as well.
So that your research is taking place in this Philadelphia neighborhood, Kensington. Give us a sense of what this place is like and some of the buildings that we're talking about here.
Sure. Kensington is a post-industrial area. So it used to sort of be an industrial center for Philadelphia. Once those factories closed, there's a lot of industrial buildings that have been left abandoned. In addition to that, people have moved out of the neighborhood for various reasons. It's also got home to the largest open-air drug market on the East Coast. But in the midst of that, there's been a resurgence of development in the area, which has contributed to, there's actually, I think it's one or two of the top hipster flipping, that's actually a technical term in that area. And so you have this development amidst poverty and a drug crisis as well. So it's an interesting area to sort of explore these issues where abandoned buildings are both being used, seen by developers as opportunities, as well as, you know, spaces that have been used by community members for a long time.
When you say hipster flipping, are you talking about people coming into these buildings thinking like, oh, these are really cool buildings, I'm sure we could make awesome like apartments or condos out of it? Is that what you're talking about there?
Yeah, and then a quick turnaround. Yeah. So fixing them up and selling them.
Yeah. So other than that, what are we seeing some people in this neighborhood do with some of these abandoned buildings? We mentioned some possibilities there in the intro, but what were you seeing when you did your research there?
Sure. Well, I worked with a bunch of different groups, but you know, and this isn't a new thing either. And people have been using these spaces for a long time because they've often, especially in this neighborhood, they've been abandoned for a long time. Community farms, as you mentioned in the intro, community gardens, As well as informal housing. You know, I worked with a group that of homeless and formerly homeless families that take over abandoned city-owned properties to house, houseless people in people-less houses, especially when they're meant to serve as affordable housing.
Hmm. We are talking right now with Elsa Noderman. She's a PhD student in the UW-Madison Geography Department, talking about her research into vacant and abandoned properties. And Elsa, I would imagine that the city, in this case, Philadelphia, there's probably some room for conflict here. You've got people in buildings that are technically abandoned, I'm sure for safety reasons and whatnot. The city might not look so kindly on this. Are you seeing a lot of conflict between the city of Philadelphia and the people who are relying on these buildings?
Sure. Well, of course. And one of the reasons I was sort of interested in Philadelphia is one of these areas of conflict kind of emerged around conversations about the formation of a citywide land bank, which is a municipal mechanism for consolidating city-owned vacant properties and also allowing the city to acquire privately owned tax delinquent properties. And the land bank came out of a broad-based movement called the Campaign to Take Back Vacant Land, as well as other groups who put pressure on the city to undertake a land bank as a way of residents being able to access these properties easier, because it was a very difficult, convoluted process in the past, or it has been. And so, I was interested in sort of how this land bank was unfolding and how these conflicts had sort of allowed for the creation of this land bank.
And we're talking about one example of one city doing this, but this idea of a land bank, is this something that we're starting to see in other major metropolitan areas as well?
Yes, absolutely. Philadelphia is the largest city with a municipal land bank, but Detroit and in Ohio, there's a bunch of them. Around the country, land banking is not actually new, but it's sort of taken off as cities sort of recognize abandonment and quote-unquote vacancy as an issue.
So we're hearing a lot of news these days about people moving back into cities, their struggles over land ownership, housing prices we're hearing are going up. And I'm wondering if in conversations about, you know, developing some of these properties, which could be potentially worth a lot of money, is part of this involving having those residents at the table, having the people who are using the space for a garden, for an informal living space? Is that what you're kind of hoping to see here?
Yes, exactly. And I think that's starting to happen, or people put their hopes in the land bank that would allow for some community accountability and allow for community priorities such as community garden farms and affordable housing to be put forward on the table. Now, there's some disagreement about whether that's actually happened in Philadelphia, but at least it's brought those sort of questions to the table and desire for resident participation. And by resident, I mean not only property owners, but also, people who don't own property, but who consider a neighborhood home.
Is that kind of a big ask for the city, though, especially when you might have a real estate developer knocking at the door, ready to pay the city that might own this property a lot of money?
Yes. And, you know, I think Philadelphia, which has had a lack of development for many years, in the current development boom, just sort of was excited to take advantage of this new development. And so it said yes and yes, yes to new development. But at this point, there's concerns that that development has led to mass displacement of people and, you know, gentrification, which people have argued that has led to displacement of local residents increased in affordability of this in the city. So I think it's a question over, highest and best use, which is traditionally defined as in terms of market value. But I think what's coming to the table is that there's other values to consider, such as environmental values, social values, values of racial equity. And so I think bringing those to the table for the city is important for long-term, if you want a city to be a diverse place. Mm-hmm.
And it seems like cities, too, all over the country now are trying to find an identity, especially if it's a city that, you know, once was defined by industry. They're trying to find the next thing. Are you hoping that part of this is maybe that cities can capitalize on some of these unique features to sort of build the identity of the community?
Yeah, I think as long as residents are part of identifying what that identity is, rather than sort of a creation of a new identity for a new set of residents moving into a city, that I think current residents are feeling left out of that process, or often feel left out of that process, and that the city already has an identity. And so, you know, how can that be incorporated into, you know, a form of development without displacement, which is sort of the tagline that the Campaign to Take Back Vacant Land has used.
So where does your research go from here, and what's next for you?
So I'm currently writing out my dissertation, so there's that behemoth. Really, you know, I, through my research, developed a lot of relationships with community groups and did research, you know, action-based research that would be useful to them, not just in terms of my dissertation. And I ultimately hope to, you know, turn parts of my dissertation into more publicly accessible pieces, whether that be white papers or more publicly facing articles, as well as I said, these sort of individual pieces I've done for community groups as well.
Well, that's a good place to leave it. Elsa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Elsa Noderman. She is a PhD student in the UW-Madison Geography Department. She joined us to talk about her research into how people are breathing new life into vacant and abandoned buildings in Philadelphia. It's Food Friday. Summer is here, and that means it's peak season for melons. Well, it's not far off. Melons can be a great snack by themselves, but can we make them a little more exciting?
That's the challenge we laid down for our resident foodie here at WPR. It turns out there's a lot we can do with melons, including curry, ice cream, even putting them on the grill.
Lori Skelton is a WPR classical music host and a regular on Food Friday. Lori, thanks for being here today.
Hi, nice to be with both of you gentlemen.
So lots of melons that we could possibly buy this summer. Can you give us a quick rundown of the types of melon you're going to be talking about here today?
Well, here's something that's going to blow your mind.
I'm ready for it.
In Wisconsin, we have watermelon and we have muskmelon. And if you're saying, well, where's the cantaloupe? Where's the honeydew? Where's the cassava?
Where are they?
That's all part of the musk melon family.
Okay.
If you're going to get technical, all of those other melons are musk melon. It tends to be in this state, we refer to musk melons as a cantaloupe or a honeydew that's actually been grown in Wisconsin with a seed that's formulated for our soil, our growing season. If you're getting melons at any other time than late July into early September, if you're getting them from the grocery store, they're coming from Florida, they're coming from Arizona, they're probably not going to taste as good as what we can grow here. Melons need a long growing season with intense heat, which is why I still get freaked out when I see watermelon in the grocery store on Memorial Day weekend. Mm. That's not how I was raised. You know, if you see watermelon before August, it's just not good.
Now, before we get to making anything with melons, one tough thing, and I still have trouble with this, knowing when it's ripe. And it's something I think you pointed this out to us. Paula Poundstone voiced her frustration about on Wait, Don't Tell Me.
I try to teach my kids to eat healthy food, but you get a cantaloupe and you don't know when it's going to come of age. You have no idea that period between when it's like hard as a rock to when it's smushy inside is about 10 minutes.
Right.
And ring sometimes dings. You got to wake the kids in the middle of the night because the cantaloupe's ready. Your kid wanted Fruity Pebbles just so he could sleep.
All right, so we're at the store or farmer's market. There's the melon. How do we assess the ripeness, Lori?
All right, a musk melon should smell like very fragrant flowers, either roses or sometimes something a little bit muskier. Pick up your melon and shake it. If you hear loose seeds, that's a ripe musk melon. You can give it a little gentle pressure on the sides, not on the end, believe it or not. And you don't want it rock hard. But unless you really like soft melons or you've got a recipe where you are going to be pureeing it, and it doesn't matter if it's a little bit mushy, you don't want the outside to have too much give. With watermelons, you make a fist like you're going to knock on the door. You give it the thump test. It should sound dull. If your watermelon sounds hollow, if there's a sharp knocking sound, that's not a ripe melon. If you've got two watermelons that are the same size, pick them up, and whichever one's heavier, that's the one that's going to be riper. Look for small scratch marks on a melon at the farmer's market. That's an indication that it was pollinated by bees. So you're assuming really good care was taken of it. And also, you want to look for those waxy crisscrosses on the outside of a muskmelon. That's called netting, and that's an indication, if you've got good netting on that melon, it's a good indication that there hasn't been a lot of liquid lost. So there again, that's a way to keep a melon fresher longer, just by getting a better melon to begin with.
So one of the things that I am guilty of falling back on is going to a summer grill out. I buy a watermelon at the store. I've done the test that you've talked about. I haven't gone full on Gallagher to it. I've given it the little knock. I bring it home. I cut it up. I put it in a bowl and I call it good. What can I do to spice that up a little bit to make it a little bit more exciting and a little bit different for my guests?
Start with just one or two additions. If you've got a good melon, you want to celebrate the melon. You want to enjoy that distinctive flavor. So I would say pick one, maybe two other things to add to it. Berries or cherries are a good idea. Citrus always works with melon. Maybe a kiwi, maybe a mango. Almonds, hazelnuts, pecans, those are all great with any melon, sweeter salads. You want to get a little more exotic. Musk melons play really, really well with lychees and macadamia nuts. Watermelons are good with pistachios and pomegranate seeds. And just start with a couple of little things. And then if you want to go full on big cornucopia of fruits, you can go a little bit ahead. But start with a couple. You may want to throw in a little bit of vanilla to bring out flavor. Or if there are adults at the party who don't mind some alcohol, sweeter spirits. Brandy is always good. Grand Marnier, Kirsch, Sambuca is really good with melon. And you also might want to add a real healthy handful of a chopped herb like basil or mint. Or if you have tarragon, maybe not so much tarragon as mint, and if you've got anise hyssop, that's a lovely thing with melon.
And you also mentioned watermelon and feta cheese salad.
Okay, now that's getting away from the sweet. That's going towards savory. And when I put this up on Facebook, this was something that got a lot of attention. Ina Garten, Barefoot Contessa, has a arugula, watermelon, and feta salad. Watermelon loves salt, and salty feta cheese is great. So Ina Garten's recipe is a citrus vinaigrette, orange and lemon juice with a lot of chopped shallot and olive oil. You toss that with a little bit of kosher salt, a little bit of watermelon, and feta cut up about the same size, 6 cups of baby arugula, and you toss that all together. Again, chop up a lot of mint leaves. It's very easy. The lovely thing about this salad is that you can throw all the ingredients except the vinaigrette in a bowl, have the vinaigrette separately, then take it to your potluck and toss it right at the table so nothing gets soggy. It's a great dish to pass. And yeah, this came up. One person mentioned it on my Facebook feed, and everybody piled on. It's like, oh, yes, this is incredible. And you can find it easily through the Food Network. Just look for Ina Garten's arugula, watermelon, and feta salad.
It is Food Friday, and we are talking about cooking with melons here on Food Friday with our regular foodie guest, Lori Skelton. And Lori, you said that watermelon loves salt. Another thing that watermelon tends to love is spice. What should we do if we want to heat up our watermelon or muskmelon in general?
Sweeter spices like ginger are great with any melon. Watermelon really likes cinnamon. And some people might want to play with a little bit of cardamom or nutmeg. Some people, though, find that melon is going to bring out more of the menthol flavor in those spices. So be very careful when using those. The other thing that melon just loves is chilies. Standard street fare in the Southwest in Mexico is you get a cup with wedges of mango and melon and jicama that's been sprinkled with salt and ground chilies and lime juice. Alice Waters of Chez Panisse out in California makes up a chili lime salt. Tablespoon of crunchy, flaky sea salt, teaspoon of ground chilies, and the zest of one lime. And she recommends making this in a big batch, keeping it on the counter, and just using it throughout the summer, just sprinkling it on melon wherever you want to go. So that's a good way to get started, the heat. Tabasco, oddly enough, can be fun with
what?
Melon. Yeah, just a little. but there's, you've got that lovely, cold, sweet melon. It just like playing with salt and heat with a good caramel or a good chocolate. You know how that will bring out layers of flavor by adding just a little bit of heat. It works with melon as well.
It's Food Friday. Lori Skelton is with us. We are talking about using melons in new and creative ways.
We want to hear your ideas as well at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite way to use watermelon, honeydew, cantaloupe, or something else? Do you ever cook with melons, throw them on the grill? Whether it's sweet or savory, what foods do you like to pair melons with? And what questions do you have? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Coming up, grilled, pickled, and curried. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Chris Molina. Right now, we're picking up our Food Friday talk about melons with WPR's Lori Skelton.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a favorite fruit that you pair with a particular kind of melon when you're making a fruit salad? Do you do something wackier with melons? Cooking with them? Making salsa with them? Grilling? Call in at 800-642-1234 or call with a question for Lori. 800-642-1234 is the number. You usually, Lori, say you don't want to cook with melons. One exception is a recipe you've shared with us. It's at WPR.org/Food Friday, a curried watermelon.
Now, melons are 90% water, and so it's hard to cook with them because spend any time on heat and they're going to disintegrate. But melons, for the most part, were developed in India centuries ago. So it would make sense that there's a curry for watermelon. Mm. From Rajasthan in the northwest part of India, start with about 5 cups of cubed watermelon. Take 1 cup of that, throw that in the blender, and that's going to be the start of your curry sauce. And then you will toast cumin seeds, a little bit of garlic in your pan with the oil. Add some coriander, turmeric, cayenne pepper. There again, you got your little bit of heat. And put in the pureed watermelon. Cook that down a bit. Then throw in the rest of your watermelon cubes. They're only going to need about 3 to 5 minutes. Mm. And they'll be coated with this watermelon sauce that is infused with great spices. Sprinkle cilantro on top of that and serve on top of basmati rice. This is one of the quickest curries I've ever come across. And even though it's cooked, it's still incredibly refreshing.
Now, outside of that, I have heard of tossing watermelon on the grill. I've never done it myself. I'm assuming if I did it, it would just crumble and I would be sad. But what advice do you have if somebody wanted, perhaps this weekend, if they're outside grilling, if it's not too hot out there, what advice do you have for someone to throw a melon on the grill?
Start with thick slices, for one thing. And if you have a really sweet melon, you won't need to add anything to it. If your melon maybe doesn't have quite the flavor it's going to have in August, you might want to brush it with some olive oil and then lime juice. Maybe you want to get clever and caramelize and sprinkle a little bit of vanilla sugar or some other flavored sugar on top of it. Keep your slices thick. It's not going to need much time on the grill, but if you've already made your basic melon salad and you're thinking, you know, this is kind of boring, simply grilling the melon is going to add that incredible caramel, that smoky, wonderful flavor that may be all you need to do to jazz up a summer salad. Then, too, because melon is so refreshing, if you're just grilling the slices of melon, that's a great thing to add if what's on the rest of your grill is really, really hot. Mm. Melon is great if you're doing Jamaican jerk, if you've got a really hot barbecue sauce. Having those chunks of melon alongside, it's tying in with the flavor because it's grilled, but again, still refreshing, still a good thing to have in the summer.
And let's talk pickling of melons. I've seen, I buy my pickled okra at the grocery store. I came to that late in life. And next to it is the pickled watermelon rind. Let's start with that. This is something we can do at home.
Watermelon rind pickles are a southern staple. And if you want to do a quick pickle that will keep in the fridge for a couple of weeks, you take your watermelon, take the very outer hard green rind off, chop them into 1-inch pieces. You're only going to want about 1/4 inch of the flesh. You really want to stick with the rind. You can cook that down in a hot brine, probably with a little bit of chili, star anise, fresh ginger, kosher salt, black peppercorns, sugar, and unseasoned, maybe rice vinegar for something a little bit softer. You're going to want to cook that in the brine for about 30 minutes, cool it down, and then store it in an airtight container. Again, that'll keep in your refrigerator for about 2 weeks. If you want to do something even quicker, take thin slices of melon. If it's really thin, you can even leave the rind on if it's a muskmelon, and just put it in a basic cold brine, a little bit of white vinegar, water, a little bit of salt, a little bit of sugar. All that's going to need is about 30 minutes, and then you can slice that up and slip that on your burger and surprise everybody with new kind of pickle.
We're talking right now with Lori Skelton here on Food Friday, talking about getting creative with melons, muskmelon, cantaloupe, watermelon, you name it. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you like to do with melon? Even if it's just chopping it up and putting it in a bowl, that's fine. But you get creative with it. Do you put it on the grill? Have you tried making a curry with it? We want your melon recipes at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lori, we just talked about pickling rinds. Another technique that we can use, maybe not so much for the rinds, but for the melon itself, is candying them. Do I have that right?
Now, this is a really good save if you've cut into a melon and it is either rock hard or it has started to go mushy. Cut the flesh up into 1-inch pieces, again, toss with sugar, maybe a flavored sugar, and stick in the oven for about half an hour. 400 degree oven, 20 to 30 minutes. What you're looking to have happen is have those pieces start to break down a little, but also start looking like roast squash would be at Thanksgiving. Mm. You want that caramelization on the outside. I don't know as I would make an entire salad of that, but it would be an amazing garnish. You can candy pieces of melon in a sugar syrup on top of the stove. In that case, I would be more inclined just to make a really good, interesting sugar syrup, maybe one with lavender or pink peppercorns or bay leaf, and then just serve the melon pieces in the sugar syrup.
We heard from Marsha on Facebook, who recommended a marinade. So make it a marinade with melon. This is going to be cantaloupe oil, maybe olive oil, I don't know, lemon herb, curry powder, and salt. Yeah. So that sounds pretty good. What would we marinate in that?
This is a friend of mine, Marcia Lawton Raleigh from Backyard Patch in Illinois, and she has this for chicken or pork. I'm not quite sold on the idea of marinating beef in this mixture. Where salsa, or where melon is really good with beef, is making a salsa. This is one where you'd use a melon that's going to be a little bit firmer, chop it into very small dice with red onions, cilantro, a little bit of oil, and serve that on your grilled flank steak as a side.
Well, with it being really hot this weekend, I'm thinking about, I'm going to have some family over this weekend, thinking about making some stuff that's a little on the cooler side. Mm. Summer popular option is doing a cold soup. Fruit soups are one option. Can watermelon be worked into something like a gazpacho or something like that?
Watermelon is a great thing for gazpacho. And if you're making the real easy thing, not an ice cream that requires a churn, but granita, where you puree something wonderful, add some sugar, and then put it in your freezer in just a container that you scrape up. You don't have to actually churn it. Granita makes a great garnish for other cold soups, for other gazpachos. Basic melon soup is about 3 cups of melon to the juice of 1 lime, maybe 1 lemon, 1/2 orange, depending on your taste, and then some good vinegar to bring out just a little more flavor. Cold melon soups are you can really have a lot of fun with them, varying how sweet you make them. You may want to have them as part of a breakfast buffet, or you can get the cured meat. You know, melon and prosciutto is a classic pairing. If you fry that prosciutto or fry some bacon, that makes a really good garnish for a cold melon soup at dinner time.
And you mentioned we're not quite in season yet. It sounds like this would be a great time to try these recipes then. If we're going to the store, it's maybe not the awesomest just cut them open and eat them melons in the store quite yet. This is a lot of great ways to do something with them.
You do need, I think, to jazz up what's available in the store right now. And you can get very, very creative, I've discovered. It doesn't have to be the main flavor, but it is something you can throw into, say, your poke bowl. A little bit of melon added to your tuna is really, really nice. Melon loves those Thai flavors of nam pla, the fish sauce, with a little bit of garlic and lemongrass. It does love, again, that salty thing. It does love soy. So maybe you're making a cold chicken or shrimp salad that has more of those flavors. And go ahead and throw in a little melon. There, it's really good if the melon is on the firm side. If anybody has ever used melon with a salad that's dressed with mayonnaise, I really want to hear about it. I have better luck if you're working with sharper cheeses, like mozzarella, like burrata, or like creme fraiche or a tangy yogurt. I think that's a better dressing for a protein plus melon in your salad.
Okay, that's all well and good, but talk to me about dessert. Talk to me about how we can incorporate watermelon into a frozen treats.
Basically, anything you'd put in a salad, you should put into a blender and freeze. You can make easy popsicles for the kids. That's, you know, just throw in some fun stuff in the blender, let them choose, and let them freeze their popsicles. Again, if we've got adults in the mix, granitas, you don't want them frozen solid. That's the perfect time to throw in maybe some tequila, maybe some sake, and you've got a lovely icy adult dessert to play with. If you're going to make a melon ice cream, it does work, but depending on how sweet your melon is, you may want to add some other flavors. You may want to use sugar syrup to flavor it. I generally think that you need more sugar for a melon ice cream. You will want to heat your milk and sugar first on the stove. Let it cool down. Then throw that milk in your blender with your melon. You want this as smooth as possible if you're going to put it in an ice cream churn.
Well, that sounds like a great place to leave it. Lori, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Lori Skelton is a WPR classical music host and a Food Friday regular. She was with us to talk about getting creative with melons, from getting them on the grill to including them in frozen desserts. There is still time for you to share your recipes over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And speaking of recipes, you can find a couple of Lori's suggestions at WPR.org/Food Friday. We've got that watermelon curry and I think the pickled watermelon rinds over there. And if you are a fan of pickled watermelon rinds, I always look at them at the store and think, do I really? You eat those? I'd love to hear from you. Tell me if I should try them out. Again, WPR.org/Food Friday.
Father's Day is this Sunday. It's a time for us to take a moment to appreciate all that our dads have given to us and, well, all that we've taken from them, including the clothes off their back.
The magazine GQ ran a fun piece today asking its editors to weigh in on the best piece of clothing they stole or otherwise obtained from their dads. Answers range from a favorite watch to a denim jacket featuring the image of Kermit the Frog.
Well, Rob, you're a dad. Has any one of your kids stolen any clothing from you?
No, I don't think they'd want my clothing. It's not cool enough. And, you know, I'm a little bigger and my dad is like considerably taller than me and he's considerably bigger than me. If I ever wore any of his clothes, it would look like a small child wearing their parents' clothing. So that was kind of off the table for me.
So I don't know if I stole it or I borrowed it, but I ended up with one of my dad's shirts, which I thought was pretty cool. It was a yellow and green plaid button down short sleeve shirt. I loved this thing. I thought it was cool. It had this really ridiculously large collar on it. And I asked my dad about this shirt later, and he said, you know, I had that for a long time, and I never wore it because I thought it was so ugly. It was also the shirt that I used to hide money in because I needed a place to hide money. Unfortunately, when I got the shirt, I did not find any money in the pocket. There was nothing in there. But thank you anyway, Dad. It was great shirts.
Oh, my kids did a couple times use old T-shirts as, like, art smocks at, like, in kindergarten or daycare or whatever.
I was going to ask if they took
that was about it.
To, like, mop something off the floor.
Yeah. Oh, that's happened. Yeah. That's happened. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.